In today's episode of the show, we're covering 70s book covers. Join us in the Whispering Gallery as we take a trip back in time to check out these unusual, bizarre, and beautiful book covers.
The science fiction book covers we're sharing are from 1964 to 1978, but in order to understand a little bit more about what inspired these artists, we wanted to take a short walkthrough of what had been recently going on in the world. Some of the well-known artists from the 1800s to around 1950s-ish included Cézanne, Seurat, Matisse, Picasso, and Dali. Authors like Jules Verne, 1828 to 1905, were writing science fiction with books including 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in 1870, Journey to the Center of the Earth, 1864, and From the Earth to the Moon, 1865. The illustrator for that book was Henri de Montaut, and this is a quote from the Wikipedia page on the book From the Earth to the Moon. It says, during their return journey from the moon, the crew of Apollo 11 made reference to Jules Verne's book during a TV broadcast on July 23rd. The mission's commander, astronaut Neil Armstrong, said, 100 years ago, Jules Verne wrote a book about a voyage to the moon. His spaceship, Columbia, took off from Florida and landed in the Pacific Ocean after completing a trip to the moon. It seems appropriate to us to share with you some of the reflections of the crew as the modern-day Columbia completes its rendezvous with the planet Earth and the same Pacific Ocean tomorrow. Unquote. From what I understand, these books were considered pulp fiction and were not under the umbrella of science fiction yet. From 1919 to 1933, the Bauhaus changed art and design forever. While not focusing on the school, I'm going to read from the book Bauhaus Archive by Taschen. It shows a new way of thinking about things. Party, work, play. Itten taught under the motto, play becomes party, party becomes work, work becomes play. The same link between work and play was in Gropius's mind when he wrote the Bauhaus Manifesto. Theater, lectures, poetry, music, costume balls. Creation of festive ceremonies in these gatherings. And indeed, the everyday life of the Weimar Bauhausler was punctuated by many such events. Gropius introduced Bauhaus evenings of literary readings with the intention of bringing together the local population and the youth of the Bauhaus. While the inhabitants of Weimar adopted a distanced, even oppositional stance to the Bauhaus and its pupils, many students were to remember these evenings for years to come. This was from page 37. In October 1957, Sputnik, the first human launch satellite, orbited around the Earth. It stayed up for 3 weeks and had been built by the Soviet Union. We're talking about the time period of the Civil Rights Act. Here is a quote from the History.com page on Civil Rights Act of 1964. Quote, when John F. Kennedy entered the White House in 1961, he initially delayed supporting new anti-discrimination measures. But with protests springing up throughout the South, including one in Birmingham, Alabama, where police brutally suppressed nonviolent demonstrators with dogs, clubs, and high-pressure fire hoses, Kennedy decided to act. In June 1963, he proposed by far the most comprehensive civil rights legislation to date, saying the United States will not be fully free until all of its citizens are free. Unquote. Women's liberation was kicking off later in the 1960s and ran through around the 80s, and man landed on the moon on July 20th of 1969. It was an interesting time with a lot of liberation in the air, and the culmination from groundwork echoing out from the Bauhaus into art and design, the satellite Sputnik from the Soviet Union, Frenchman Jules Verne's fiction from the 1800s stepping into the light of reality, the time period held Dali's surrealism and Hugo Gernsback's Isolator. Some science fiction was becoming science fact. If you watched cartoons in the 70s, you'll know George Jetson's video calls, and that's become a reality in what many of us are doing as we work from home right now. So hang on, it's about to get far out, man. Put your safety goggles on as we're entering the unknown territory of science fiction book covers of the 60s and 70s.
What's better than exploring tall bookshelves that run on and on for an entire city block? We parked at a meter on one side of the bookstore and checked out at the street on the other side of the building. Everywhere you look, there are books, and a lot of them. I'm not exaggerating. City Books is a huge bookstore. I don't think that I've been in a bigger one.
Powell City Books is the largest used and new bookstore in the world, occupying an entire city block and housing approximately 1 million books. Located in downtown Portland's Pearl District, the City of Books has 9 color-coded rooms and over 3,500 different sections, offering something for every interest, including an incredible selection of out-of-print and hard-to-find titles. Dozens of acclaimed writers, artists, and thinkers visit each month to read in the Basil Hallward Gallery, located upstairs in the Pearl Room, and a one-of-a-kind rare book room draws bibliophiles from near and far to browse an impressive collection of autographed first editions and other collectible volumes. And Powell's Books was established in 1971.
It's located in Portland, Oregon, so when we took our big trip up to Oregon last fall, that's one of the places we stopped, and it was... I had never been in such a big place. I followed Dad up into the science fiction section, and it was huge. You know, like pillars and stuff with numbers on them telling you how to get around, and color-coded floors, you know, and not floor, but like the different levels were color-coded.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I came up some stairs, and Dad was standing at a, are they called turnstiles, that are like the displays of books? Uh-huh. And he had found some that were, I don't know if it's collectible, but, you know, the collect these for just for the art, I think was what he said was on that turnstile. And so he had already grabbed some books for me, and then we were looking at the different art on them. And that's where kind of the idea started forming about talking about science fiction book covers from the 70s. So anyway, so that's kind of what started this. There's a sampler of art we've started uploading to the internet. We slowed down a little bit on some of the posts with what's going on with the coronavirus, which we hope all of you are staying safe and doing well or making recovery. And so it's just kind of a lot on everybody's minds right now. So we hope that this podcast can give you a little break from it. And us too, as we do our research, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, isolation is a beast.
Yes. I think as a lot of people are discovering around the world. A sampler of the art that we got includes astronauts and robots, a racy jungle scene, and knights with laser guns. The billowing grandeur of giant spaceships. This is me writing alone again. So
I love it.
But yeah, the racy jungle scene is just like, what? But I'm sure it will get posted, but it's the figure, the rendering of the figure is just extremely well done, but it's just like she could use a little more clothing than a bikini on. So,
for sure.
I mean, the mosquitoes would take her down in any jungle. So.
Oh, absolutely.
So what are we talking about today, Em?
We haven't cracked any of these open yet, but the art is worth checking out. Come with us into the 60s and 70s and see the magic of artists making something unreal into something visually in our grasp. Let's check out the handful of book covers that are representing.
In the 1960s and 70s, well-known sci-fi is still known, and the book cover art. As I was thinking about it, Ray Bradbury, Arthur C. Clarke, Frank Herbert are all authors that were published in the 60s, and they had staying power as storytellers, so much so that we know them still today. Like Dune, I think, is in process for being remade. I don't know if it's like a series or a movie, but that's pretty cool. Yeah, and the pictures that Herbert painted in our imaginations of giant sandworms and ingenious ways of catching water. And then there's the 2001 A Space Odyssey that is timeless, you know, looking at business being conducted as usual in space until all at once it isn't, and it's full of stars. Do you have any favorites from the science fiction realm?
Well, 2001 is always a favorite because Dad put that on when I had my wisdom teeth pulled. And it was the trippiest movie to watch. I like the kind of genres between like fantasy and science fiction. So I really like Magic Kingdom for Sale, all of that kind of stuff that kind of combines like you're warping into like a different like galaxy or universe to like interact with fantasy.
Yeah, Pierce Anthony does that.
Yeah.
Paramount too.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a little
funky. I do really like his, I can't remember the name. It might be The Immortals, but just that series. Yeah, that's...
To Ride a Pale Horse and Burying an Hourglass. Yeah, those were really interesting.
Super good. Also, Hitchhiker's Guide. That whole series by Douglas Adams is just amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome. And Don't Travel Without a Towel. And
yes.
Here's the answer. The number is 42 or something is our answer.
Life, the universe, and everything.
Sci-fi has been a lot of fun and a lot of escape over the years for us as readers. The style kind of shows up in the 70s from commercial artists and what we know of the cut and paste and overhead projectors that were used during that time period. A lot of montage work was going on.
What description of clouds and sunsets was to the old novelist, descriptions of scientific apparatus and methods is to the modern scientific detective writer? And that's a quote from Hugo Gernsback.
Awesome. So do you happen to know who Hugo Gernsback is?
I have no idea. I feel like I'm fairly well read in like fantasy and science fiction, but not a clue.
Thanks to the Google, I found out who it was because I was like looking at where the Hugo Awards came from.
Oh. And
he is the man. Yeah, so we get into that in a little bit farther down the line. But yeah, he was the inspiration, and he was an inventor. So when I put up that invention, the isolation headpiece that he had, it was really for concentration, but it really looked bad during what we're going through with the coronavirus.
Oh, no.
It looked like, because there's my breathing tube, and I was like, wow. So I took it down because it looked more scary than anything. Oh. The first book we're going to talk about is The Sky is Filled with Ships by Richard C. Meredith. The colony planets were in revolt against Earth. The back of the book reads, Starship Captain Robert L. Janus had only one loyalty to the firm he worked for, the Stellar Trading Company, and with good reason, for STC was not just a merchant corporation. For 1,200 years, the vast complex of companies that called itself STC had maintained contact between Earth and the multifarious worlds peopled with its colonies, giving help, support, financing, and protection wherever and whenever these were needed, without regard to politics. Inevitably, and precisely because it was neutral, STC had come to play a powerful role in intergalactic affairs, more powerful indeed than Earth itself. Now that neutrality was threatened from within the firm, and Janus knew they would all be destroyed in the Holocaust. They also advise, and don't miss, is it Robert Silverberg? Is it a typo on my part? Dimension 13, Edmund Cooper, Deadly Image, and Anne McCaffrey, Decision at Duna.
McCaffrey is amazing. I love her.
Love the Dragon books. Yeah, she's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of geek out, and I didn't really do it on any of the others, so I don't know if we want to go this far because it's a little obnoxious.
I would say go ham.
In talking about the cover, the title is in lowercase spaghetti thin letters in white. It's stacked in three rows on the top left corner of the cover. Below the title, Richard C. Meredith, and below that, in sentence case and smaller font, the colony planets were in revolt against Earth. A black ribbon on the top states original, and a thin stripe of text on the left top, running vertically along the spine, Ballantine, science fiction, 75 cents, 01600, the Ballantine logo. Now let's roll up our sleeves and take a look at the painting. Okay, so this is where art history kind of, like the analysis kind of geeked out a little bit on this one, so we may not go into this deep of a level on everything, and this might be good for helping you sleep too. So it's kind of dry, but okay.
Very relaxing.
Yes, here we go. Happy little trees. So, okay. Happy little palettes. Okay. The palette includes purple, gray, black, and pops of orange. There are 14 spheres. I don't know if these are worlds or moons. They're surrounding what looks like a spaceship rising out of the bottom middle left, and it rises just over halfway up the book cover. The spaceship is a well-rendered piece of engineering that has been imagined, but thought out and visualized. Ladders, antenna, landing areas, windows, observation windows. I'm not sure what the purpose is for everything, but there looks like purpose was woven into the design as the artist planned the layout. There look to be landing bays with garage-like doors, perhaps a balcony launch platform. Lights dot platforms in the top of the ship. It looks as though it were built on a cone, wide on the bottom to narrower on top, perhaps with something that looks like a shipping container running through the top and antenna that look like baseball field lights, like the lighting panels for baseball fields. A large planet or moon sphere floats behind the ship, and a few fuzzy faded spheres also in the distance. There are a handful of smaller spheres in the foreground. There's one black sphere that's small, one well-rendered orange sphere, well-rendered meaning light and shadow, two larger spheres, and two to three smaller purplish-white. The look of the ship is solid and almost like it's a small multi-level building, like five stories, give or take a little. This painting is for sale right now at fineart.ha.com, Heritage Auctions, and the artist was Jerome Podwill, an American born in 1938, and it's an acrylic on illustration board, 19.5 inches by 12 inches, done in 1969. The sky is filled with ships. Copyright 1969. The next book is actually two of those sly dogs. That's... So when you have annihilation factor in plywood, if you look down, it literally is you flip the book over and that's on the other side. So they have two books of one.
That's cool. I wish they still did that. Something was gravely wrong on Sequoia, the planet of trees, peopled by silky furred lemmets with large golden eyes. The male and female lemmets abhorred one another and would acknowledge each other's existence only at the annual mothering. The rest of the year, they were deadly antagonists. Miss Kearney Wynn of Earth, investigating the strange civilization, realized that something was changing. She drew mental diagrams and watched the black smudge on her pocket computer grow until it ate up all the other cultural trends. What was the new factor which the computer couldn't analyze? Why was it overshadowing the long-established cultural pattern of the lemmets? There were no answers to any of these questions until the lemmets started their march through the tree heights. Then, for an instant, Kearney saw the truth, but it was too horrible to believe.
Wow, I almost need to go read this now.
I'm pretty stoked about it.
I'm like, almost? I'm like, it could be a good read. Yeah, that's...
Sucker for the dot, dot, dot endings, though.
What was too horrible to believe? I must know. And, yeah, what happened to her clothes? I don't know.
All right, so on this image, we have a mainly kind of bluish, and I would say purple backdrop. It is a forest scene, although it kind of looks like no forest I've ever seen. It's really, like, the trees are super, like, knotted. They look like the trees that Tarzan slides down in the Disney film. But, yeah, so the title is in all capitals. It says Highwood in a kind of nice orangish yellow tone. It's very 70s. then the author is right below that, Neil Barrett Jr. And then there is, on the true world, the war of the sexes was endless and inexplicable. Just a short description. And then there is the focal point of this piece. It's very hard to miss her. So there is a female in a very scantily clad bikini and some thigh-high white go-go boots. The bikini looks like it's kind of made of, like, maybe some, like, leather strips or, like, some leaves. But those go-go boots, she bought those at, like, Penny's back in the day or something. And so a few, they kind of look like, I can't tell if they're supposed to be, like, human hybrids or if they're monkeys. But they're, like, there's a few that are, like, reaching for her arms. And then there's another human, I think it's a male, who's grabbing her leg. Kind of like how Leia grabs Luke's leg in the Star Wars poster. But yeah, so I love this. I think it's super tacky, but in, like, the best way.
And she kind of looks like she's floating.
It kind of looks like, this is probably uncharitable of me, but it kind of looks like he, like, the artist rendered the background and then rendered her figure and then, like, cut her out and, like, stuck her on and then, like, added the monkey to, like, ground her, like, in the frame.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I still love it. I think it's great.
Yeah, and his rendering of the form is really beautiful. It's
just
the shading and stuff
too. Like, just that skin, it really, like, it reads as skin 100%.
Yeah, his proportions are on, and
mm-hmm.
for a scholar that sits around all day, it's quite a bit.
Yeah. So this is on the backside of the book that we were just talking about, Highwood. So this is the book that you flip it over and you have a whole other novel. So the title of this is Annihilation Factor by Barrington J. Bailey. Annihilation Factor's cover has kind of like an off-white background. And then in the center, kind of center bottom below the title, it has kind of a futuristic robot. It kind of almost looks like a robot bust. And then below that, it has a circle, which almost looks like a porthole, and it seems to show what I believe is a planet, and then, like, a spaceship flying by. The spaceship kind of looks like it's, I don't know, like, cylindrical with a point. It has kind of, like, an ellipse with the fuel as, like, the jet propulsion as it kind of comes around this planet shape. It's really cool. It's pretty futuristic. It kind of looks almost like the, was that Aerosmith? That had the cover of, like, the Marilyn Monroe robot. That's kind of what the bust kind of
reminds me. I don't think I've seen that one.
Let me see if I can find it. Hold on. Yeah, just push play. It has the same kind of, like, head shape.
Is that a portal or is it a planet?
I don't know, because it kind of almost looks like...
It's like the robot's hanging onto it or something on the bottom.
Yeah, it kind of... I don't know. To me, it looks almost like a futuristic sculpture that would be, like, floating somewhere, you know? So it's, like...
Yeah. Maybe we'll find out what it is as we read the opening.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Caster Cracknoe believed he was waking from a nightmare. Opening his eyes, he found himself lying on his side on a concrete pavement. Near him were bodies collapsed like rag dolls. They were all dead. The whole planet of Carol was dead. Prince Peridon had been having a violent and unpleasant dream. He forced himself awake and rolled off the couch. Faintness, vibrations, an overwhelming desire to give in, to lose consciousness, assailed him. Paradin stumbled out of his apartments into the bright outer offices. The offices were littered with unconscious forms. The prince struggled on. The patch was happy. It had eaten well. It rested, savoring the flavor of the planets it had devoured. Then it began to move, following the slip line, drifting onto yet another inhabited world.
Wow. The patch.
That's pretty good.
The hungry patch. Okay, yeah. Sounds interesting.
The hungry patch. That sounds like not okay.
The patch was happy. That's so cute. Sorry. I can't even breathe. I'm like, oh, okay. Oh, the patch was happy. Okay.
The patch was happy.
That's cute. Science fiction can be defined as imaginative extrapolation of true natural phenomena existing now or likely to exist in the future. And that's from Hugo Gernsback. In 1926, Gernsback started Amazing Stories, one of the earliest magazines dedicated to the genre. He started in science fiction, and let's see, he made his first piece to fill space in his magazine, Modern Electronics, with a piece of science fiction. So this is from Smithsonian Magazine, smithsonianmag.com. They say, eager to deliver exciting and prophetic content to his followers, Gernsback founded Amazing Stories in 1926, conceptualizing it as the perfect outre complement to the more rigorous material of Modern Electrics and the similarly themed Electrical Experimenter, first published in 1913. The purview of the new publication was to be scientification, wild tales rife with speculative science. Yeah, and wild is what we're hearing even in the 70s, huh?
That's, yeah. Like,
anyway, to continue, they say, in an early issue of Amazing Stories, Gernsback laid out his foundational mission statement. Having made scientific fiction a hobby since I was 8 years old, I probably know as much about it as anyone, he wrote. And in the long run, experience will teach just what type of stories is acclaimed by the vast majority. Within the text of the editorial note, Gernsback exhorted himself to give the readers the very best type of stories that you can get a hold of, while recognizing fully that this would be a pioneer job. Again, that was from Smithsonian Magazine. Okay, this next book we're focusing on was published by Pyramid Books, R-1015, for 50 cents, in kind of a collegiate font, I guess, is what the book title is in.
Yeah, it says it's 10, like Letterman jacket.
Yeah, totally. It's 10 Years to Doomsday. Okay.
Yes.
By Chester Anderson and Michael Kurland, a science fiction novel. And under that it says, a space invasion and one desperate chance for Earth to save itself. And it looks like they're breaking the rule of design that you don't want to go past 2 or 3, really. Looks like they're doing a mashup of many. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different types. So, okay, not... That's all the type on the front of the cover. And then we have a gradient background of white from the bottom through blue up to purple and violet. And then the letters on it, of course, of the title are bright yellow to stand out and contrast strongly against that. So then we have on the bottom left the turrets of a castle with a flag. And then on the right there is a rocket ship. I say rocket because it's more like a tall, thin, traditional rocket that takes off. And in the bottom left-hand corner, we have what looks to be some sort of knight or fighting person wearing boots and tights and
looking good.
Tunic. Yeah, Yeah, red tights, or what are they? Kind of like, I don't know, orangish. And a sword in the hilt, a red cape, and a tunic, and some weird contraption on the back with, it looks like electric coils, maybe, that might work together or something.
Yeah, it looks then like that.
The man is wearing a helmet that looks like part of a bullet, and then he's aiming a laser gun at, he's got a sight on it too. Like, I haven't seen many with that in my science fiction watching days. And he's taken aim at this space rocket, and just that gun has broken it off at the top, and it's falling over. It looks like it's melting even. Down by the castle, there are a couple of other fighters with spears and the bullet cap protectors made out of metal. And that is the gist of what we're looking at here.
All right, and the description of 10 years to doomsday on the back of the book says, "Contact! The image in the battlecruiser screens grew, and it was clear that this was a new kind of ship, a new race, the first new civilization the Federation had met in 300 years. The crew's excitement mounted. The newcomers would be invited to join the Federation. The crew would be all heroes and would be awarded enormous bonuses, and the stranger opened fire with an impressive battery of weapons. The cruiser's defenses cut in automatically, and in a few seconds, the unidentified ship was nothing but an expanding cloud of radiant gases. After 1,000 years of peace in space, there was a war on. But who was the mysterious and deadly enemy?"
Do, do, do.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like this is like a Mystery Science Theater episode.
This is awesome. And then at the bottom, I guess if we continue our description, the back of the book's blue with yellow contact and big bold, that same collegiate letter, like the Letterman's jackets. And then at the bottom, there's a ship, might be the same rocket ship, I'm not sure. It's flying through a black sky or the black of space. But I'm not sure if it's clouds, like if it's in an environment, or if it's passing nebula.
I read it as, it's really weird. That, like, two-tone process definitely, like, knocks a lot of detail out.
It kind of looks like they took a Sharpie to the background behind it, like they had to knock it out so the ship would sit out.
Yeah.
They might have cut and paste, and then, oh, no problem, I can fix that. So anyway, okay. But it's a well-done drawing of the the ship. So, yeah, not to be critical, and nobody's here to defend or to explain what they were doing. So.
Yeah, it sounds like we're talking a lot of trash, but, I mean, honestly, like, these are great. Like, all of them are really, they're really nice.
I mean, I remember comic books when I was growing up with, like, you know, the different castles, and I can't think of the name of them at the time, but there were cartoons in the Sunday morning papers, and you would totally just, like, park it. And, well, once my dad had read them, then I could read them. So, yeah, I gotta wait for Grandpa.
Yeah, so, similarly, I had the same thing with Grandpa. Don't touch it until Grandpa's read it.
Yep. It's fun. It's, like, the more serious royalty or Prince Valiant, I guess it was, comics.
All right, so here's a little about the Nebula Awards, and this is coming from nebulas.sfwa.org. About the Nebulas. The Nebula Awards are voted on and presented by active members of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, Incorporated. Founded as the Science Fiction Writers of America in 1965 by Damon Knight, the organization began with a charter membership of 78 writers. It now has over 1,500 members, among them many of the leading writers of science fiction and fantasy. Lloyd Biggle Jr., the SFWA's first secretary treasurer, originally proposed in 1965 that the organization published an annual anthology of the best stories of the year. This notion, according to Damon Knight, in his introduction to Nebula Award Stories 1965, Doubleday 1965, rapidly grew into an annual ballot of SFWA's members to choose the best stories and an annual award banquet. Since 1965, the Nebula Awards have been given each year for the best novel, novella, novelette, and short story eligible for that year's award.
One other award in the science fiction genre is the Hugo Awards. You can find lists of the books that are awarded the prize on Amazon.com. The HugoAwards.com answer the question, why are they called Hugos? Quote, the Hugo Awards are named after Hugo Gernsback, a famous magazine editor who did much to bring science fiction to a wider audience. Gernsback founded Amazing Stories, the first major American science fiction magazine, in 1926. He is widely credited with sparking a boom in interest in written science fiction. In addition to having the Hugo Awards named after him, he has been recognized as the father of magazine science fiction and has a crater on the moon named after him. Again, that was from the HugoAwards.com. Hugo is spelled H-U-G-O.
My bright spots of the week have been getting the chance to read during this lockdown, and also getting the chance to pick up embroidery. I'm really enjoying this new hobby, and it's been fun to add some personal touches to different pieces of my wardrobe.
A good moment I had recently was making banana bread. More specifically, what my family calls leftover bread. The recipe uses up overripe bananas, an extra applesauce cup, those spare chocolate chips that kick around in the cupboard. I added banana extract and doubled the Mexican vanilla, and it turned out really good. It was good to be motivated to bake again. I shared my recipe on Instagram, so you can try it too. It's a mashup from my Better Homes and Gardens cookbook that was a wedding gift, a few online recipes, and the roots of it go back to me making banana bread and running out of oil. So I used applesauce. It's a really good comfort food bread. The butter, banana extract, and Mexican vanilla really make it extra good. Another bright spot was actually on the nightly news tonight. Child donates vital medical gear to hospital in Virginia. Hospitals are running out of protective equipment for doctors and nurses, but while politicians point fingers, a young boy in Virginia is getting things done. Chris Van Cleve shares his story. What happened was he wanted to help, and he collected gear from hotels nearby, things like shower caps for the doctors, face masks. If you go to cbsnews.com, you can either look it up by April 2nd on the nightly news, or this is a long URL, but it's worth it to see the story. cbsnews.com/video/child-donates-vital-medical-gear-2-hospital-in-Virginia. I hope that could be a bright point in your day. We'd like to say thank you for joining us on this adventure through faraway jungles, with rockets and robots. It's been a great adventure into the realm of science fiction book cover art. Before we sign off, we want to thank Skype and archive.org for the following music: Skyscraper, The Jetsons, and Boy Piano Boogie by the Piccadilly Pipers, Clem Moorman, and Edward McLean, used under fair use.
That's it for today's episode. We hope you're staying safe and staying inside. Thanks for listening.